In the studio this morning, I have Bill Watson, who is the New Zealand Coordinator for the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Bill has also spent a certain amount of his time at sea. He worked for several conservation organisations right back to the early 1970s, when he was a charter member of the Oceanic Society, founded in his hometown, San Francisco. He's also been a surfer for 50 years and a beach lifeguard, and he has crewed on several Trans-Pacific racing yachts, and he himself sailed to New Zealand on his own yacht, arriving in 1975. And from that perspective, he learned of the plight of the oceans from direct experience, specifically the Pacific gyra from the dumping of toxic waste off the coast of San Francisco, etc. So, kia ora, Bill. Thank you very much for coming in.
Kia ora, Kim. Thank you for inviting me.
Bill, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, it really stirs us up when we hear what's going down in the southern oceans, particularly with the whalers coming down to kill these magnificent creatures.
In our own backyard.
That's correct. What's happening, please?
What's happening? Well, naturally the Japanese are doing everything they can to prevent us from having a successful campaign this year. That's what's happening in the here and now. And how are they doing it? Well, the Japanese are really cool on tactics. They understand the nature of warfare. And there's a Japanese saying that politics is business and business is warfare. And so they are trying to influence through politics the passport and free entry into Australia of Paul Watson, who's not related, but I consider him a brother from another mother.
Yes.
If you go back to 2007, we were very glad that Aussies voted for Kevin Rudd and for Peter Garrett's Labour Party because they promised to get tough on illegal Japanese whaling. They promised to take Japan to court. They promised to send a ship down to the Southern Ocean to monitor illegal activities. And they even criticized the Howard government for not doing enough. But then, political promise, I suppose, is an oxymoron, Tim.
I understand.
And in the last 2 years, Rudd and Garrett have done just the opposite, much less for the whales than the former environment minister. See, under Ian Campbell, Australia was the toughest voice at the annual meetings of the International Whaling Convention. And Garrett has really caved in under pressure, and the whales have become a minor concern for his government. But under Campbell, Sea Shepherd was given encouragement, they were given support, and just the opposite's happening now. We're being disparaged, we're being harassed. It looks like this is even going to be sabotage if they're able to pull it off. Peter Garrett doesn't want the Steve Irwin to return to the Southern Ocean in December. Why? Because the Japanese government has requested that the Aussie government intervene to prevent us from returning to the Southern Ocean. So they're mobilizing every bureaucratic measure that they can to prevent us from engaging the fleet that's doing the poaching. They're leaning on the Dutch government to strike our flag. They're leaning on the Aussie government to intervene. They made requests of the U.S. and Canada to prevent Sea Shepherd from continuing our efforts to defend the whales.
And the New Zealand government?
The New Zealand government is untested on this issue. It has not come up, to the best of my knowledge, in any way since the Nats gained power last year. So, what does that mean? It means that we could be the deciding factor, the pivotal point. We could essentially take that responsibility from Australia, even though the Aussies themselves really want this to happen. In other words, the Steve Irwin is right now in Sydney Harbor, and it has been coming down the east coast, stopped in Brisbane, and on its way around to Fremantle. Now, it's getting a tremendous reception everywhere it goes. People come out in droves. But the Australian government is making it difficult for Sea Shepherd by challenging Paul Watson's credentials and whether, in fact, he would be a legal entrant into the country. Paul's entered and re-entered Australia dozens of times without incident. But now, only a few weeks after the Australian foreign minister was given an ultimatum by Japan to stop us, visas for Paul and some of his key crew members have been cancelled, and new applications have been denied. So he's got his ships there, but he's going to have to fly in, and then they're going to send him away. They're demanding police reports from Norway and Canada and the U.S. to process the visa applications. But you know how that goes. Once the reports are received, they'll be informed of additional requirements. And so they'll try to make us jump through bureaucratic hoops for months to try and prevent us from rejoining the ship in Australia. So we're going to have some tactics of our own. And we're also going to hopefully be getting help from, in some form, from New Zealanders and the New Zealand government, because one of our very own is going down there with them as well in the Earth Race vessel. So we've got a new strategic tool to add to our kit.
And the Japanese are always, it's a financial manipulation, of course.
Absolutely. It's all about greed, isn't it? And money. In other words, trade is what is the economic engine for the planet. And Japan is in the catbird seat, as it were. It's in a pivotal position to
leverage their way.
Leverage is the word I was looking for. I just had this image of a chicken wing and a half Nelson, but leverage is the right word, yeah.
Yeah, so there could be a possibility that we may have to swing it over to Port Chalmers, Dunedin.
Well, we don't know yet. In the end, Paul Watson will make the call on that, but I'd like to feel that that Sea Shepherd would be welcome to go about their refitting business and for their captain to be given free entry into New Zealand without any question. I think that in the Howard government, we had a more equivocal stand at the International Whaling Commission than Australia did. They were stronger advocates than we were under the Clark government because there was that same pandering to trade, if you will. I think that's the primary reason, because the Labour Party certainly espoused the values of protecting whales and other sentient beings. But the talk hasn't been walked quite as well as it perhaps should have been, but the National Party has an opportunity here to do something really important for the planet, really significant. And we're just going to see if they're going to extend themselves in that direction, whether it's service to self or service to others. That's the bottom line.
Very good. Okay. Yet some people also see the Sea Shepherd Conservation Group as a terrorist organization, which, I mean, I've had Paul Watson here in this studio. Mm. So theoretically, I've been harboring a terrorist in this radio station. Why do you support Sea Shepherd?
Tim, I have a lot of respect for a group that's prepared to stand up and do something in support of its values. And Sea Shepherd is a direct action organization. They're not just whinging or bearing witness to a slaughter and using it as a photo op or creating origami whales or something like that. They're actually doing what is exactly needed to be done to protect the whales. They've damaged equipment, for sure, but they've never hurt anyone at sea.
And nobody's ever been killed.
No one's ever been killed. And there's been no serious injury where somebody has been maimed or something like that, where you can't say that about France, which killed somebody on the Rainbow Warrior. I mean, the crew of the Sea Shepherd are the real Rainbow Warriors. They eat vegan on the boat, they're unpaid, and they're all passionate about what they're doing. And they have that value that, okay, we're going to fight fair and nobody gets hurt. But at the same time, it is a fight. I mean, we're not going to deny that we are confrontational, because we definitely are. And we're doing it to protect a species.
A magnificent species.
A very magnificent species, yes. And last year alone, we prevented the slaughter of almost 400 whales. Now, each one of those whales, from what I understand, is worth the equivalent of about $110,000 to the Japanese. So if they want to play economic games, we can play economic games too. That's where we want to hit them, is in the pocketbook. And for every whale that they don't take, it costs them money. That's what we're trying to do. And that's one way that Earthrace is going to be a big help this year. It's going to be quite a unique combination, I think, of Steve Irwin and Earthrace.
Yes, for overseas listeners, the Earthrace Can you quickly tell the listeners about this incredible boat?
It's a world record holder, Tim. It looks like something that Batman would cruise up in. You could call it a trimaran, but it looks more like this huge bug, because you've got, from the main hull out to the sponsons, you've got things that look like the golden arches. And then it's got a couple of, how would you put it?
Like antennae.
That come out at about 60-degree angle from the center cockpit. It looks like a jet plane that has had its wings bent into 180 degrees with pods at the end. And is it fast? Yes. In terms of kilometers an hour, I don't have all of the exact details on this. I think it's around 60, but it's plenty faster than any of the whaling boats there. And it holds the world speed record for circumnavigation, 60 days around the world in a biodiesel craft. We won't be able to use biodiesel down there simply because the water's too cold. It doesn't work in those frigid temperatures.
And the other thing, too, it punches right through waves where it doesn't have to go over the top of the wave. It can go straight through the wave. Mm. And it has had up to 5 meters of water above the top of a cockpit as it goes under the water through that wave.
Yes, it can travel 6 to 8 meters in a straight line, wave piercing.
Yes.
So it keeps on going. And what we hope is that there's no ice at the end of the wave, because it's been reinforced with half a ton of Kevlar. It still is not an icebreaker.
Very true. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the story with Greenpeace? Because you would think that Greenpeace would be right in there, because originally they started off so well and stating that we had to save the whales.
Mm-hmm. I can't speak for Greenpeace. I don't know what's going on inside, but I do have a personal observation and perception from the outside. I did work with Greenpeace back in the 80s when it was closer to a direct action organization. But 2 years ago, the Esperanza was tracking the whales down in the Southern Ocean.
That was a Greenpeace boat?
Yes, that's the Greenpeace boat. And they found the fleet first, the whaling fleet. And we radioed them, and they refused to give us their position or the fleet's position, which essentially meant that they didn't want us to be involved in the campaign down there, in the action. And that did a lot to damage relations, as you might imagine. I was on the phone to Bunny McDiarmid straight away and very unhappy about that. But I think that's a policy change that's occurred in the Netherlands at head office. I mean, they're a very different organization from we are. I mean, they used to be almost the same in terms of values and goals. The difference has always been in methods, right from the beginning when Paul left the organization, because he was one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, of course. But you see, Sea Shepherd has been awarded a 4-star charity rating by a leading charity evaluator, which essentially means that we are outperforming most other charities when it comes to responsible fiscal management. We don't have a big overhead. We don't have huge office buildings and CEOs with 6-7-figure salaries. We don't pay our volunteers or people who go out signing up donors, whereas other organizations do have all those things. And so all of our money goes to buying fuel for the vessel, and we're quite responsible.
Very good. A lot of listeners may have seen The Cove, which documented the slaughter of the dolphins in Taiji, Japan, and this also is part of what Sea Shepherd was doing. Sea Shepherd hosted the screenings of this movie in New Zealand and Australia. Did Sea Shepherd have a role in making this movie as well? I know that George Lucas was involved.
Yes, George was involved, and that was mainly with the making of the
hidden cameras?
Yeah, what the cameras were hidden in, that's right. Very, very clever. And the mechanics on the inside of how the cameras move to follow the action. But actually, Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd, Paul Watson was in the film. For those who saw the film, they know that he spoke about how Taiji came to be discovered, as how the activity came to be discovered. And it was actually Sea Shepherd that initially found out about it. But of course, we're not a big enough organization that we could have done anything about it at the time. That was in 2003. And so we have this film that hasn't really been made for 6 years since the discovery, because it took that time for the right people to get involved. Luis Saihoyos and Rick O'Barry, the two prime movers. But the film is causing a bit of trouble right now in two levels. According to Rick O'Barry, it's sort of like a tsunami of bad press for the Japanese. And only this last week, it was announced that the Japanese caved into pressure and they're going to be showing The Cove at the Tokyo Film Festival. This promises to have significant impact on the attitude of the Japanese people toward slaughter of cetaceans, because it hasn't been widely known what's been going on in Taiji and with the taking of dolphins and whales. And this has only just come to light. And there's going to be a lot of anger, because one thing that the film says is that the school children are getting lunches from the whaling society there that are loaded with dolphin meat, and that has a thousand times the mercury level that's accepted. So that means that they're poisoning their own people. Now, once that word gets out, that could be a very significant change in the way people like us are viewed by the Japanese, by the average Japanese, and that's got to influence government opinion. You see, the government there changed for the first time in 54 years in August, and that change, we were thinking that that change might be significant in terms of attitude towards whaling and towards taking the dolphins, but so far it hasn't been. We're a little surprised by that. Well, I shouldn't say we. This is a personal opinion. But I have worked with the Japanese for quite a long time in my other job, as it were. I specialize in helping people fast-track into Asian markets. But the control of the whale meat industry has been intimately connected with the government and with a criminal element, we believe.
A criminal element?
Yeah, like what they call it, Yakuza. And the Yakuza is an Asian mafia. So the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other question that a lot of people say, well, climate change is a real big one. And why does the Sea Shepherd not focus on that? Well, I can understand. I'd want to save the whales too, to be perfectly frank. Somebody's got to do it. Mm-hmm. The rest of the planet can be more involved in climate change.
Well, we feel that we're doing our part for climate change, that in fact that organizations that focus on climate change are spreading themselves very thin because there are so many different aspects of it. One of the things that is important to me is that we get respect from those organizations because we are doing our part. And we would like to see all the organizations that are concerned with climate change pulling together and supporting each other in ways that are appropriate, and not sort of throwing rocks because, oh, you're not doing enough, you're just working on whales. You can't say that that's just enough or not enough. That's actually taking off a big chunk, and we're taking risks in doing it too. I mean, there hasn't been a life lost yet, but the way things were going when we called an end to the campaign last year, there could have been. The Japanese were getting extremely aggressive. That's been shown in whale wars. Last year, the Australian government boarded our vessel when we came to Hobart and confiscated some film. And that film, which fortunately we had a copy of, became the basis for this year's whale wars, which shows graphically how aggressive the Japanese have become in their approach to interference with what they're doing.
There's two things. There's the sentience of these whales, these great creatures, magnificent beings, at one level, and then the other level is that how can a human being go out and kill them?
Well, it's a consciousness issue, Tim, and I think that sometimes our consciousness changes when we have a direct experience with, like, for example, I've had personal experiences of interspecies communication. I was sailing here, actually, from San Francisco in 1974. It was around Christmas time, and we were off the coast of Mexico. And we had planned to drop a hook in Tenakatita Bay, which is halfway to Manzanillo from where we were going, and we missed the tide, and the current was against us, so we couldn't get into the particular bay that we had picked. Now, what happened was then we had to sit on the helm for all night, and that wasn't a lot of fun. So about 11 o'clock p.m., a pod of dolphins started playing around the boat. And they stayed with us for about 10 minutes. Then they disappeared in the direction of the coast. A few minutes later, they were back, and I got it. They wanted me to follow them, so I kind of breathed real hard and headed toward these black cliffs. And, you know, there's rocks, and there's no lights in the Mexican coast. It's a pretty scary place, trust walk. So, but they guided us right into the bay. They came right out to the anchorage and splashed and played some more and then raced out to sea again. But they came to the yacht initially and played around with us. And then they started veering in toward the coast. And I had sat there thinking, gee, it's been nice, guys. Thanks very much. Then they came back about 3 or 4 minutes later. And they played around again, and they swam in exactly the same direction. And so my partner and I thought, right, maybe they're telling us something here. So we followed them, and they took us where we had planned to go but couldn't get to.
And this goes again with down in the Southern Oceans. Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd couldn't find the Japanese fleet, but they found that the whales pointed the way.
That's right.
Can you explain it a little bit more?
Well, I haven't talked to Paul since that incident, but I understand that this big humpback, I think it was, put his fin high in the air and then slapped it down in the direction where they were, and did that 7 times as it was traveling with the Steve Irwin. Steve Irwin changed course, maintained course, and found the fleet. And so it does appear that there was some kind of interspecies communication going on, because the whales know, and the whale song travels. You can hear, or another whale can hear one of their own species in Auckland Harbor that's down in the Southern Ocean. That's how far their song carries, even farther actually. Several thousand miles through the ocean.
Well, I'm aware that the sperm whale, when it goes down deep, because a sperm whale's got a brain that's 3 times the size of a human brain, mm-hmm. when they go down to a kilometre and a half and send out their series of clicks, mm-hmm. they can communicate virtually right around the planet at that level. So mm-hmm. the world whale web has been in place for
30 million years.
Yes. And here we are, we humans, haven't got an understanding.
Mm. And have a multiplicity of languages that can only be understood through interpretation, whereas they can all understand the language. So, yes, they've got a much more cooperative society. We have a lot to learn from them, from all the cetaceans. As far as the size of the brain, it seems that they have evolved different functions in their brain, but one thing that they share in common with us that makes us know that they are highly conscious beings is something called spindle neurons. Now, spindle neurons are sort of like express trains in the brain. They're in the prefrontal area where the action takes place. That's only 5% of the brain, but it's where most of the thinking activity occurs. And these spindle neurons connect to the posterior lobes, but they don't go through a whole series of synapses. They go direct, and they communicate feelings just as we do. So they are self-aware. If you hold them up to a mirror, they can recognize themselves compared to another whale or a picture of a whale or something like that. And they are also highly sensitive to the feelings of other beings. So when they're in a pod down in the Southern Ocean and one of them gets harpooned and it's dying for 20 minutes, Japanese say that that doesn't take that long, but we've documented thrashing whales going up the factory ship that have been in the water thrashing for 20 minutes. So they're dying in front of everyone's eyes, and it's being heard for thousands of miles. So, you know, it's not very nice to do something that might be smarter than you are.
Well, one of the things is that whales don't attack mankind. So they are more evolved than us because they actually have this unconditional love going.
Yes, well, I don't know if it really is unconditional love, but it seems to be that way. And certainly we don't have any, other than the demonizing that was done by Herman Melville about Moby Dick, great white evil whale that Ahab was going after, but that's very much a Western thing. To get back to the spindle neuron side of things, they have a greatly increased ability to experience the feelings of others. And this is something that was noted by a researcher back in the 60s, John Lilly.
Center of a cyclone.
That's the man. He's the one who actually invented isolation tanks.
Altered States.
That's right. His work in Altered States was real pioneering stuff. But he also had a center where he worked with dolphins in the Caribbean. And he had government contracts and the whole works. And he just one day decided that he was going to close it and get out of that business. And when he was asked why, he said, because I have too much humility to study an animal that is smarter than I am. And he meant it.
See, this is the beauty of the cetaceans, dolphins, and the whales, because, one, they don't have to have ID. So whoever they are, they can express themselves to any other dolphin or cetacean, and there's no lies, and there's no subterfuge, there's no con. This is who I am, and everybody realizes that. They also, of course, don't have to have a passport. They can go anywhere and are accepted, and they don't have to pack a bag, and they don't have to have a shave or a wash. All these things which hold us back with our material world, they can live so free. And, of course, a lot of dolphins in particular live in joy, total joy.
They're not reliant on a global economy to do that. And I think that basically, we've trapped ourselves with our system, and I'm not making any predictions, but it looks to me like should the system collapse, that people will come a lot closer to living like whales and dolphins, that they will be more or less forced to cooperate with one another and to live in pods like hamlets or small communities where there's a lot of trust and shared endeavor. And I think that it will be a lot closer to nature as well. At least this is my hope.
I'm speaking with Bill Watson, who is the New Zealand coordinator for the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Bill, there has been some interesting relationships evolve with communicating with whales. There's a thing called infrasound. And infrasound are these waves that hug the ground or hug the water and travel for long distances without losing their strength and are basically unstoppable. And there's a woman in Hawaii, Joan Ocean.
Yes,
I've met Jane too. And she spends a lot of time not only with dolphins but also with whales. And she finds that when she gets up close to the humpbacks seem to be the more lovable, approachable of these beings, that the contact is such that when she leaves the water and goes and stays in her house beside the shore, they're still connected through these infrasound waves. It's as if the whales who have their sing-song in the water have this ability to even move the sound above the water across the land. And she's finding that she's far more sensitive. And there's lots of information that can be sourced on the web, if you want to go to joanocean.com, about what these whales are here for. They're repositories of knowledge of possibly celestial events that cover more than even this planet.
Well, one doesn't have to believe that to not want to see them slaughtered, but I happen to agree with you. I don't have a lot of hard data to support that, but I have an intuitive sense of it because I've been in their presence, in other words, sailing back from Hawaii to the States once, we were to California. We were caught in a whole gale and we were towing warps for 3 days and we were in 50-foot waves with combers breaking over the transom. So it was like
a terrifying
wild ride for a while, yeah. And when that storm abated on the fourth day, the waves didn't. They were still 50-footers, but there was no wind. And so you'd be bobbing about, and it'd be like being on an elevator. You'd go up 50 feet, and then you'd be at the crest, and you'd see all sorts of things, and then you'd go down, you know. And that carried on for quite a while. And in that time, a whale, it would have been close to 50 feet, came up to our 36-foot yacht and took a look at us and swam around. And then he went beneath the yacht and scratched some of the barnacles on his back on our keel and came and had a look at us again and sailed off. Now, I've also heard of yachts being sunk by whales. And I think that there's an energetic resonance or frequency that they're aware of in all beings where they can sense the vibrational level you're operating at. It's sort of like being with a whale for me has been sort of like being with the Dalai Lama, to be honest with you. It's like there'll be an afterglow that'll last for a couple of days because there's some kind of frequency, there's some kind of note that's been put out there that resonates at a very, very deep level, deep within inside the soul. And I think that whales, that's why people love to go on whale watch. It's not just the sighting. It's more to do with the actual experience of being in their presence because there is that vibrational quality.
The ambience.
Ambience is a... Yeah, I suppose you could use that word. But it's deeper than that.
Yes.
What is it?
To many, it's a spiritual experience.
Yes, it is. It has been for me. And I've been in the water with whales and dolphins and manta rays, large manta rays, in different parts of the world. So I've had an abundance of joy and more than my share of those kinds of spiritual experiences, so for which I'm blessed. And we didn't talk about the dolphin convention. I was sailing north from New Zealand and on my way to Hawaii, and 55-day passage. And we came out of the hatch one morning and there was a dolphin jumping alongside of us. And as I kind of picked the sleep out of my eyes, I noticed there was some aft and then there was some over on the port side. And so I thought, oh, okay, we're in a pod. And then I stood up on the deck and I saw nothing but dolphins for as far as my eye could see in any direction. And we were in the middle of literally thousands of them, and it was a convention. And if you asked me where I was, I could only tell you within about maybe 500 nautical miles, because I don't have the ship's log, and it was 1,000 miles from the nearest point of land, Tim. It was like all of these dolphins were just out there because somebody had something special to celebrate, obviously. You know, that's one of the beauties about this kind of consciousness, that they can produce this sound that travels for thousands of miles. And so if there's a need for them to get together, they can come together.
And so it was euphoria for you for that.
It was. Yes, yes, it was. of course, the first thing we were interested in is, well, who's out here? And so we went down and we got our little book on, you know, marine mammals, and we came up with 7 different species of dolphin that we were able to count within a few hours.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, it makes you wonder.
Definitely, definitely. But, and this is why you're with Sea Shepherd Conservation Group right now, solely because you realize that these unique beings are sharing this planet with us, and we're not only ignoring them at one level, we're taking their lives at the other.
We are. And the Japanese want 1,000 of them this year. That's the
whales.
Whales, yes. And we don't want to let them take one if we can. So we're going to do what we can to ensure that they take the minimum number possible. That's our objective.
About 20 years ago, Greenpeace had a lot of people protesting outside the Auckland airport with placards showing them about the whaling, etc., that the whalers were doing down in the Southern Oceans. And all the Japanese tourists who were coming off the aircraft didn't know anything about it. They were completely unknowing of what was going on. And I feel sometimes the society in Japan is quite fragmented to the degree that part of a society just doesn't know what other parts of a society are doing.
Oh, I think that's true. And it's even worse today than it was at the time that you described. But what's happening as a result of things like the Cove and all of the notoriety that Japan has been getting, that they just simply can't prevent the public from knowing through the newspaper about what they're doing. But the issue in the Japanese society is face. And face is
the saving of face.
Yes. Face is an Asian thing, and it is to do with, it's like a report card on the social level. You belong to different groups, and in each group you play a different role. And so the face that you have in the group depends on how you behave. Now, the Japanese think that we are bad actors, just as we are very unhappy with their behavior as well. But face is a deeply ingrained thing there, and they're going to keep doing what they're doing because they're right and they know it and they're proud of it. And it won't be until a huge tsunami of public opinion, international opinion, goes against them that they're going to change their attitude about this. That's one of the things that the Cove will do. That's one of the things that Sea Shepherd does, because we are a direct action organization, and things like Whale Wars that's been on televised and the actions of Sea Shepherd vessels have created international attention. Now, some would say that's negative attention. We consider any attention positive, because these people are doing something illegal. They're doing it for greed reasons. In other words, it's economically motivated. They say that it's research-oriented, but they haven't produced a research paper of any note since the formation of the Cetacean Research Society in a country that is famous for its scientists. That organization, to my mind, is a hoax.
And the blubber is on the open market?
Absolutely. Yeah, and they've got freezers full of it that they can't, big, huge warehouses full of it that they haven't been able to sell. And the same is starting to be true with the dolphin meat. And that's largely because of the efforts that we have made over the years to educate the people of the world about what's happening, so that a tide of public opinion can change that on the global level. The other issue that will be possibly resolved through public opinion is the Pacific gyre. Actually, the gyres around the world, because, you see, Sea Shepherd is a conservation society, and we're for the protection of the oceans as well as the creatures that inhabit it. And in 1975, I sailed through the Pacific gyre for almost a day in plastic. And that was how many years ago? 34? Now, I don't know how big it was at that time, but I was quite appalled by what I saw. And I think that when people finally realize how much plastic is out there and what it's doing with the PCPs and all of the things that are breaking down and actually causing devastation in the ocean, that we'll see some change there. So obviously one of our objectives is raising consciousness in that area as well. And I can think of a lot better uses for those Japanese fishing vessels cleaning up the Pacific, their own backyard as well, with the factory ship maybe rendering down the plastic or something. But it's time that we started thinking outside the square in how we can actually start transforming our environment to something that's more like it was, because we certainly made a colossal mess of it over the past 150 years.
That's right. It's only been the last 150 years that mankind has gone out and really pillaged everything.
Mm-hmm. Mass production and so mass pollution goes along with it.
So it comes down to consciousness. We've got to have a conscious population, conscious government. We have to realize that we're only going to get there through higher consciousness.
Absolutely. Yeah. That, to my mind, that's where the last battle will take place, is on the field of consciousness. Because people need to start thinking at what Ken Wilber called a second tier level. Yeah, the first tier is all about opposition. In other words, this is the way I think and I'm right and you're wrong. But at that second tier, you begin to see the rightness in everybody's issue, but ways that they can start working together for the benefit of all. And that's kind of idealistic, I suppose, but I think that it's within possibility to get critical mass on that within the next few years at the rate things are happening. And we're actually, with our confrontive direct action tactics, we're accelerating. We're part of the wave that is accelerating that process of making people more conscious, because we aren't going to make it, not just as a species, but as a planet, if we do not start cooperating with one another in more effective ways.
And you're finding that there's not going to be a great divide, political divide, between left and right. Everything will have to be ecologically conscious. We've got to be working with ecology. So you're going to get people from the left and the right realizing that this planet is loans us bodies in which to live, and it's furnished us with all the resources we require, plus other kin in the form of whales and dolphins.
Absolutely. It's got to be driven by a different paradigm altogether. We can't continue the way we have been going. We've got to take a look at the really basic underlying systems that have been governing our civilization. Now, we've gone far afield of little tiny sea shepherd, but in the end, this time here, that this very, very brief flick of a time that we have on this planet, is either in service to self or service to others. And I think that we've got to look really hard at the extent to which we are engaging in self-serving behavior and start looking at the plight of others on the planet as well, and what we can do with our abundance of resources to start sharing those in ways that are going to make it effective and fun to be here for all. Because everybody's getting more and more stressed out, aren't they, Tim?
I can tell you that. A mass uprising of consciousness.
Let's hope so.
Thank you, Bill. And the Sea Shepherd website?
www.seashepherd.org. Real simple. And New Zealand will be represented on there.
Bill, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tim. It's great to be here.
That was Bill Watson, the New Zealand organizer for the Sea Shepherd Conservation Organization, at seashepherd.org.